it became this enormously influential study. I think not because it was scientifically good. Actually, it's a really good example of everything that can go wrong in science, but because it told us something that we already wanted to know.
You started talking publicly about your views on human nature as part of a defense of UBI, that's universal basic income. Mm-hmm. So this idea that if you give people money, you know, they will actually be more creative and kind of, you know, flourish much more as human beings because we are friendly and collaborative. There have been lots of trials on this now, lots of kind of smaller scale trials in lots of different parts of the world. What does the evidence show us about what people do in a context where they have most of their basic needs?
This is actually why I started to work on this book, Humankind, because In the previous book, which is called Utopia for Realists, I had written a lot about all this scientific evidence that we have in favor of giving everyone just basically free money, right? Many people would guess that if you give people a handout, that they'll just waste it on drugs or alcohol or something like that. They'll just be lazy. But the scientific evidence points in the other direction. We've had, you know, dozens of experiments, maybe even hundreds of experiments now around the globe with cash transfers. And every single time, what you see is that kids start doing better in school. You know, people use the money really well. They spend it on education, on clothing, on their basic needs. Crime goes down. The health of people improves. You know, it works incredibly well. So in the book, I sort of collected all that scientific evidence. Then I went on a book tour and said, you know, guaranteed basic income. This is the way forward. And what happened time and time again is that people would say, well, that sounds interesting. And yeah, maybe it would work in a particular province in Canada in the 1970s when they did that experiment, or maybe in Finland, which is a very weird country. But surely you can't scale this up because human nature. Deep down, people are just selfish. People are just lazy. Civilization is only a thin veneer. Then I spoke to a friend of mine who's a Belgian intellectual called David van Rijbroek. He wrote a book called Against Election, and it's very much in favor of a real democracy, right? Which would be a participatory democracy, where basically you randomly select citizens from the population to be a politician now, a sortition. You know, it's a really interesting new idea that's being discussed more and more. And he told me about his experience during his book tour. He said that people were very interested when he described all these experiments that seemed very successful. But then, you know, after 30 minutes, they would say, well, maybe it works in this, you know, local experiment in this very weird place, but surely you can't scale this up because human nature. And then I started to realize that so many of the hopeful ideas that I've really cared about, they all relied on a fundamentally different view of human nature. And that basically someone should write that book because I used to have a much more cynical view of who we are as a species. You know, I studied history. I learned about the Milgram experiment, you know, with the shock machine, in which just average people did terrible things. I knew about the Stanford prison experiment in which, you know, hippie students suddenly turned into savage monsters. I knew, you know, all the classics, Lord of the Flies. So I realized that I had to dig a little bit deeper because you can't just convince people with just facts and scientific studies. They need a more fundamental story about who we are as a species.
You mentioned that some of those experiments that many of us will have studied at one point or another at school. What another thing that was fascinating about your book was the way that you showed that most of them were flawed quite substantially in one way or another, in such a way as to kind of compromise the findings, which we are, as you mentioned, kind of, you know, taught very uncritically when we're younger. Can you tell us a little bit more about why, what was wrong with those experiments?
Yeah, of course. So after the Second World War, the big question was obviously, how could this have happened? You know, how could people who are supposed to be friendly or cooperative, how could they behave in such a monstrous way? Because on the one hand, we might be the friendliest species in the animal kingdom. On the other hand, we're clearly also the cruelest species in the animal kingdom. You know, I've never heard of pandas that want to lock up, you know, other groups of pandas and exterminate them all. You know, that's a very human thing to do. And after the Second World War, it was very tempting to just go back to this older explanation that was already very influential in Western culture, which is, you know, veneer theory, the notion that our civilization is just a thin layer and that below that lies raw human nature. And so there was a new group of scientists who came up sort of with a brand new scientific discipline called social psychology. And they developed these very flashy experiments that really had the tendency to go viral because they have this shock value. When you hear about them, you want to tell everyone else about them. And, you know, when they are at the birthday party, you say, well, did you ever hear about the Milgram experiment or the Stanford Prison experiment? Because it has some, I don't know, it appealed to our intuition. The Stanford Prison experiment is maybe the most interesting example. So here you have a young researcher called Philip Zimbardo, who has the idea of putting around 20 students in a basement of Stanford University. And half of them, he assigns the role of guard, and the others are going to be the prisoners. Now, the story, as he told it afterwards, was that very quickly the guards became really, really sadistic. They did all kinds of horrible things to the inmates. And the message, obviously, of the Stanford Prison Experiment, and it really went viral also because there was footage of it, was that, you know, this is what people are basically like. You can have perfectly healthy students who call themselves pacifists, but turn them in a bad environment and or put them in a bad environment, and just a couple of days later they'll be monsters. This became one of the most influential experiments in psychology. You know, pretty much everyone who studied psychology in the Western world in the last couple of decades will have heard about it. It's in all the textbooks. Philip Zimbardo became the most influential psychologist alive. I think he still is today. He speaks to crowds of 5,000 people when he gives talks. But it was only recently discovered by a French sociologist called Thibault Le Texier, who was, and this is really extraordinary, he was the first one to go into the archives of Stanford University and to really study what happened behind the scenes. And the book that he wrote about it is called The History of a Lie. And I think that's a factual description of what happened, because it's basically a lie. Well, sometimes people start believing the lies they tell, right? So perhaps Zimbardo, after all those years, genuinely believes the story he's been telling for such a long time. But it is really a lie, because we now know that these students were specifically instructed by both Zimbardo and his associates to behave as sadistic as possible. Now, many of these students said that they didn't want to do it. They said, you know, that's not who I am. If it were up to me, we would just play cards and have a good time and make some music. But then Zimbardo said, no, you don't understand. You got to do this because we need these results. Because then we can go to the press and say, look, prisons are horrible environments, right? We need to reform the whole system. And you're a progressive, right? You're a liberal hippie. Come on, help me with this. And so that's how it happened. It became this enormously influential study. I think not because it was scientifically good. Actually, it's a really good example of everything that can go wrong in science, because it told us something that we already wanted to know. Mm. You know, it tapped into this very old theory of veneer theory that was a legitimization of the status quo.
You mentioned there in the introduction to that answer, the need to find an explanation for mm-hmm. horrors like the Second World War and the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. How can we fit knowledge of historical events like that mm-hmm. into the framework that you're laying out here?
Well, this is obviously, you know, the big question that hangs over my book. How can you argue that people are friendly, you know, when you have Auschwitz? You know, when you have the concentration camps, when you have all the horrors of human history, how do you explain that? And obviously, there's no easy and quick answer to that. That would be my first point. I think veneer theory is way too simple. It's like, oh, we've got terrible things happening in history. How do we explain it? Well, because that's what people are really like deep down. I think that's a really superficial explanation. What you need is obviously a much more complex, layered explanation of what goes on. The first thing that I think we need to look at is the dark side of self-domestication, or the dark side of our friendliness. On the one hand, we're one of the friendliest species, but we're also very groupish. You know, we want to really feel to be a part of a group. Or to put it differently, we humans, we just want to be liked. We really don't want to be lonely. And that's problematic, of course. It's really, really problematic. We see in history that so often people can do the most terrible things in the name of friendliness and loyalty and comradeship. I've got one chapter in the book about why the German soldiers kept on fighting in 1944 and 1945, even though it was clear they were going to lose the war. And the Allied psychologists couldn't understand it. They were like, are these fanatics, are they brainwashed? What's going on? Then they started interviewing prisoners of war and discovered that they were really fighting for one thing, which is Kameradschaft, comradeship. They didn't want to let their friends down. And the German army command knew this very well. So they really tried to put friends together, right? And never separate them, because they knew that then they would be a more effective fighting force. So a lot of humankind is about this paradox, is that on the one hand, we're one of the friendliest species. On the other hand, that is exactly the problem. I mean, you obviously also know that progress often starts with people who are first dismissed as unreasonable and unlikable and unfriendly, etc. That is the paradox here, is that, every milestone of civilization starts off as a utopian fantasy. Mm-hmm. And the people who first come up with it, they aren't these sort of standard friendly people that I describe in this book. Actually, progress often starts with people who are rather unfriendly and a pain in the ass to other people. So I just finished writing another essay in Dutch about resistance fighters during the Second World War, with the question, is there sort of a psychological profile of the resistance fighter? And one thing I would say is that a lot of them were socially unconforming.
Rebellious.
Yeah, rebellious, etc. But both communists and Orthodox Christians were overrepresented among resistance fighters, which is really interesting, right? These revolutionaries and the anti-revolutionaries both were overrepresented, because I guess they genuinely believed something, and were not sort of the liberals in the middle, right? Who are like, yeah, this and that and can both be true, blah, blah, blah. So I don't know, it's a paradox.
I loved that, because I completely saw myself in it as a Christian socialist who was consistently expelled from school. I was like...
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Christian socialists are the most wonderful. You know, I read this one story about a... you'll love this. So there's a man named Arnold Douwes. He was one of the most important resistance heroes in the Netherlands during the Second World War. What he did is that he basically built this huge underground network in the east of the Netherlands. And he was later, it was later recognized that he helped around 350 Jews, including 100 children, survive the war. Now, before the war, he was the son of a preacher, right? His father was a minister in the Protestant church, quite strict. But then he, was completely unsuccessful in his normal life. So he wasn't married. He was kicked out of school twice. And then he went to the US and he sort of traveled around for 10 years and was kicked out of the country as a communist. You know, had a lot of sympathy for the communist ideology back then. So that's already quite a wonderful combination, I think, an Orthodox Christian with communist sympathies. And then when the war started, this guy who always ended up in fights with basically everyone, who was a complete failure in the eyes of society, he did the thing that most other people couldn't do, right? And also interesting, how did he get all these places for Jews who wanted to hide? He didn't ask people friendly, like, do you have a place? No, he just said to Jews in Amsterdam, well, come to the east of the Netherlands. I've got a wonderful place for you. Then he went there and he just, called up people's houses and he said, well, I've got two Jews here. Do you have place? And then, no, we can't do that. Well, I'm leaving now. So That's basically how he did it. It's really incredible. So, and then after the war, his life was a total mess again. He moved to South Africa. And in just 9 years, he had to change places 15 times because he ended up, got into fights with everyone. So it really makes you think that, you know, as I said, sometimes our friendliness is exactly the problem.
To continue watching this video, click the link in the top left or in the description below. Or visit iai.tv for more debates and talks from the world's leading thinkers on today's biggest ideas.